Victor Burton here, and welcome, Robert Masters, to our podcast.
Thank you, Victor. A pleasure to be here.
Well, look, today is the first day of spring in Australia, and we've been celebrating spring into optimism this weekend, which has been great fun, Robert.
Yeah, I agree with you. We've had a so-called wet and difficult winter, although the Weather Bureau says it's a dry one, but it's always lovely to have spring in the air.
And you know me, I love the daffodils in the garden, and my Peruvian lilies are now in bloom as well. So, no, for me, it's a glorious time. And I drove back from Traralgon last week from the Three Seas Country City Connect, which was part of the Latrobe Valley Festival. And I got to be the keynote speaker on that day. But driving back, the point I want to make is that the highway was just full of wattles in bloom.
It is, isn't it? And isn't it magnificent that bloom, to have a national flower in bloom? I always remember in Canberra, we always used to return for the parliamentary sitting, and driving into Canberra, the wattle was out. So we always knew in those days it was budget time. So we had to be optimistic.
Exactly. And it's Father's Day in Australia today too. So happy Father's Day, Robert.
Thank you very much. And to you as well. So it's
well,
always
thank you. I think I'm being spoilt with a pizza and lasagna dinner. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, very nice.
Now, to celebrate the first day of spring, we've released our paper on the optimism principle. And the optimism principle asserts that the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. And this principle is based on the belief that maintaining an optimistic approach is essential for effectively confronting and overcoming challenges. And Rob and I and the team have worked on this really for a decade. And just before I start to ask Rob some questions, I've got to say he's a distinguished leader and strategist with a wealth of experience in governance, public policy, organisational transformation. I'd say he is the country's lead on crisis communications. He started out life as a journalist and has survived that. And as the chair of the Centre for Optimism, and I have to thank him for that, he's been a guiding force in promoting the power of optimism as a catalyst for change. So, Robert, as you know, no one gets into the Centre for Optimism without being asked this question. What makes you optimistic? Is it life experience, mindset, or faith? Or are you a natural optimist?
Well, Victor, I love playing golf. So I'd have to say that I'm a natural optimist because as my wife often says, despite the weather, I go out and play. So I have to be a natural optimist. And that basis. But I do think it is the foundation for a quality life. And to me, it's also an inspiration because it gives you a focus on where you should be and want to be in your life. So I might say that I'm a so-called golfer optimist, but having said that, I do believe it is a foundation for life as well.
It is spectacular. The golfer always believes the next shot is going to be better. The fisherman always believes she or he will catch a fish. So I always think that it's those two activities that really mark the optimist.
That's very true. That's very true.
So look, the optimism principle states the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. Do you want to share what that means?
Yes, well, I think, as you said earlier, this is based on an enormous amount of research over 10 years plus by the Centre. But the important thing of it is that it provides an opportunity to empower people, whether you're a leader or you're an employee, in any organisation to seize growth opportunities. Now, if I take that one step back, if you look at your strategic plan, it is based principally on optimism. Your objectives, your vision, And even your tactics are all based on an optimistic outlook. And so the principle now, it's not only a mindset, but it's also a practical a business set. And I would say it's even a practical political set, as far as how politicians should act, as far as how the bureaucracy should act, right across society. This principle has an application.
I think that's brilliant. We're recording this on the 1st of September. And last Saturday, of course, the Liberal Party won the Northern Territory election. And on a Friday, I was watching morning television, and the leader of the opposition, as she was then, said, "We're heading into this with a spirit of hope and optimism." And then after she had her victory on Saturday night, the conclusion to her speech was that she was going to bring hope and optimism to the territory. And gosh, that made me happy that that message had got through.
No doubt. And if you said she can bring to that, to the territory, now that means that the principles on which she's actually making her policies and that are based on optimism. And that's the important thing. It's just not a belief. It's got practical applications.
And infectiousness, you know, you've got to be able to bring it along. You know, when I think, you know, our Prime Minister, similarly, you know, the day he was sworn in, talked about, you know, wanting his government to only deliver messages of hope and optimism, reflecting the hope and optimism of the Australian people. And I think in the zeitgeist of negativity, with the media always wanting to portray things in the negative, you know, I don't think he would say that he's achieved that totally.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I would like to see leadership take a much more optimistic outlook with their policies, to give people that courage that this country or this business is on the right path to the future, because people will respond to that, but they won't respond to negativity. And Churchill once said, you know, the pessimist sees difficulty in every opportunity, but the optimist sees the opportunity in every difficulty. And that, to me, is a great foundation. I mean, to a certain extent, I do read a lot about Churchill, and I do admire Churchill for the way he has approached his whole career, but especially in his leadership times.
Yeah, and knocked down and rose up, and knocked down and rose up. Menzies was similar. John Howard was similar, this sort of, you know, being knocked down and continuing to go. Having a look at the American election, you know, the Americans have just come out of the Democratic National Convention, and Kamala Harris called to mind the ancestors and the leaders of the past, and said that we, our contemporary generation, owes it to lead with optimism. I thought that was quite compelling, and it reminds me of George W. Bush, who in a reflective piece after he'd left the presidency said, "The American president has to be the optimist in chief." So I think it'd be interesting that the contest in America, but kind of a Trump whose optimism comes from looking to the past and saying, we want to go back to being great, and the Kamala Harris who's sort of summoning up the Obama and Clinton views, which is that notion of don't stop thinking about tomorrow, you know, the Fleetwood Mac song.
That's right. And it gets back to the optimism principle. I mean, you know, we're talking about the future and everything we do under that principle. So
exactly.
I think, you know, I'm encouraged by what she has to say. And we can't remain in the negativity. It's far too destructive. And as you know, with optimism, it does change people's outlook. And research has also shown that it does increase the longevity of people who are optimistic.
Yeah, so, you nailed it there, Rob. I mean, the science on it now, it increases longevity. There's enough scientific evidence to say it's a preventative to cancer. It's a preventative to heart disease. It slows down the onset of dementia. And in the first two cases, cancer and heart disease, as you know, it's the key indicator that people will recover under treatment. And, you know, again, I mean, if we repeat that optimism principle, the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. So yeah. Too, your health.
Fully agree. And you know, you go into the oncology wards and radiology wards, etc., and you see people who are really down on their life, etc. But if you know that you're in the hands of good practitioners and you've got some very caring people, you have to take an optimistic approach to it. So don't have a negative or pessimistic approach to your health issues, because, as you said earlier, the science is there to prove that optimism does increase your longevity.
Now, I'm going to do the barrister's thing. I'm going to do a leading question on leadership.
Right.
So you once said this: leadership and optimism are the two key elements the community wants in today's unsettled world. Leaders must have optimism as the foundation for all their policies, and they must deliver it through sound, confident, and stable leadership. Growth, employment, equality, innovation, tax, health, education, security, all require this thinking. Communities not only expect it, but deserve it. Now, that seems to me the synthesis of the optimism principle. So what's your current thinking, 2024 post-COVID, on the question of optimistic leadership?
Well, I would like to, as you said earlier, with some of the presidential candidates and even here in Australia with the premiers and prime minister, they have to instill hope. That's an essential part of what, but they also have to inspire confidence in people, and they also have to create a positive environment for everyone. So that to me is what leadership is all about. Because if they embrace those three key elements, you'll see an organisation or a government or a country embracing the future and a better outlook by the people of those organisations or the country on that. You know, and I look at, you know, some of the world's leaders. I said Churchill, you know, with many of his sayings and that. They're inspirational at the end of the day. So this is what people want. They want inspiring leadership. They want innovative leadership, but they also want to have that confidence in not only the leader, but also themselves in the direction in which they're going.
Well, when you think about those inspirational, optimistic leaders, you know, as you know, we've sponsored the Mandela Youth Leadership Summit. And, you know, what did Mandela say? He said, you know, I am an optimist. I don't know whether it's nature or nurture. I just know it's keeping my face to the sun and one foot in front of the other. That sort of persistence in the midst of, you know, imprisonment. And, you know, I visited Robben Island, you know, to be working in that limestone in the heat and writing his autobiography on toilet paper so yeah. that people could smuggle it out. So, you know, again, you know, when we think of those great leaders of the last century and the early part of this century, that relentless optimism is so much a part of it. And I know you're a big fan of Monash as well, who managed to infect his soldiers with that optimism.
Yes, that's very, very true. And I mean, not only in the theatre of war, but in civil life and in business life, you know, he brought the electricity industry into Victoria. That's a significant achievement. It turned the state around. It became a manufacturing hub for the whole of the state. But he was an inspirational leader. He gave the foundations to what was needed. And Churchill, you know, Churchill said during the Second World War, when they turned back the Germans in North Africa, that I always love his statement when he said, "Now is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it's perhaps the end of the beginning." And as you quoted others, you know, but you look at these people like Martin Luther King and that, you know, when he said, "Hate cannot drive out hate, but only love can do that." You know, these are inspirational words that encourage change in people's thinking.
And so thinking about your speciality, you know, which is advising corporations and governments in crisis communications, and I've never seen so many crises in the world. It's extraordinary. The poly crisis, the perma crisis, so many crises. In your work, how do you maintain and spread optimism in environments that might be more naturally pessimistic?
Yes. Well, there's a Chinese proverb with crisis management, and that is a crisis is an opportunity. So if you look at it in that light and start to gear your responses or your mitigation strategies around that thinking, you will start to actually lead people. You'll start to position the organization as to where it's going. You're admitting to, if it's your fault, the fault itself, that you caused that fault, but you're going about it and rectifying it and giving people the opportunity to see that we're on the right path here in overcoming this crisis. And as you mentioned, the health situation before, with COVID and things like that, people needed optimism. And I was inspired by the nurses, especially in the UK and in Europe, when they got out on the balconies and on the hospitals and various other things like that, and actually started to talk about there are positive outcomes for all of this, despite all the suffering and everything like that. We're here, we're looking after you, and we're going to see it all through. That's inspirational. That's the importance of having a crisis. When you have a crisis, you've got to be inspirational with it. And that inspiration has to translate into your tactics as well. Admit your problems, understand them, and address them, and be open and honest in how you're actually going about that.
Yeah, that's brilliant. This week I wrote a couple of articles, one a tribute to James Strock, the head of Serve to Lead, who worked in the Reagan administration and the George H.W. Bush administration, and also John Hagel, both of whom are great friends of ours. And, they, particularly James Strock, is very much an expert on Teddy Roosevelt, the Rough Riders, and, he was a sickly child who, built up that robust reputation. So when you think of the great leaders, the Monashes, the Churchills, the Menzies, the other great leaders, what are the sort of stories, that stuck with you where optimism was the key to overcoming their challenges?
Well, I think when I look at a leader, as I mentioned Churchill and you mentioned Monash, etc., but each of them distinguished themselves by looking at the situation and how that can be overcome. It's not taking a negative aspect to anything that is done. They inspire people to actually get behind them and their direction in which they want to go, but they inspire them to embrace that direction. So if in Australia, you look at some of Sir Avi Paabo, for instance, was, to my mind, a great champion of the mineral resources that we had here and how we should be developing it. So there are many, even Rupert Murdoch, he was an inspiration as far as the media was concerned, in how he decided that people need to be have a greater information base to what they're actually doing. And yes, there are differences of opinion on any of these vehicles, but having said that, he encouraged people to read and to learn and to understand the differences that are taking place in society and make your own judgments. So those types of people, I think, are inspirational. And I think we need more of them. We really do need more of them today.
I still remember Avi Paabo, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. He became, one of the senior advisors to the Estonian president and government, bringing the lessons of capitalism and a free society to a country that had been enslaved for, by that time, 50 years. And but his funniest thing he ever said was, I'm half Latvian, half Lithuanian, And on stage, he said, "And we've got to find that young man an Estonian wife so he can solve the whole of the Baltic issue." He was great. So, look, you are one of the world leaders in crisis communications. So, if you can distill that, how does optimism feed into crisis communications and the role of leaders in the midst of a crisis?
Well, to me, what does society need in a crisis? They need to have trust. They need to have trust in you, in that the way you're going about something. Now, trust has got many, and there's an argument that trust is a variable today. I fully understand that. But you have to have trust. You have to engender trust. So have trust in what you're actually doing from that point of view. Instill trust in your people in carrying it out, and then give confidence to the community in how you're carrying it out. All of that is underpinned by trust and communication. So good communication builds trust from that point of view, and that in the end builds solutions. So people will accept the worst crisis as long as you build trust in what you're doing with those target audiences. So look at it in that way.
Well, you're really passionate about the problem of trust.
Yes.
And the data shows that trust is falling, not just in Australia, but particularly across the English-speaking countries, in governments, corporations, and NGOs. I interviewed GHD the other day. They've just done a survey that showed that Australia and the English-speaking countries were rock bottom in terms of trust in institutions and leaders that they're capable of building for the future. So, from your perspective, what in the English-speaking world, more than any other part of the world, what is the problem of trust? And, why is optimism about the future falling?
Well, I think surveys are always based on negatives for a start. So that creates headlines from that point of view. But when you have global think tanks and organizations that say that 40% of global CEOs say that they don't see their companies being economically viable in 10 years, and then when you go and look at that, and it goes up to 59% do not see their companies being economically viable post 10 years. Now, that to me is a total negative from that point of view. So, therefore, if you've got the negative, how are you actually going to change that to restore the trust that people need in those organizations? And once again, it gets back to our optimism principles. If we have a vision is based on a positive outcome. It's as simple as that. And then if you have your mission, what is the mission? How are you going to get to that? It's always on a positive outcome because you're trying to achieve a vision. You may never achieve a vision, but at least the mission is there to do. And then you have your objectives. They're all based on positive outcomes. And then you have the tactics, and that's where people get involved. So they are there to actually generate or meet the objectives. And if you meet the objectives, then you've met your overall so-called mission to do it. I can go into military terms with that, but I believe that companies, organizations, and leaders need to think about it in that way that optimism is a foundation to actually build people and to bring them along into a change in their thinking, a change into the organization's outlook on today's world.
It's Victor Perton here, and we're talking to Robert Masters, and we're talking about the optimism principle, which asserts that the answer to life's most pressing problems and questions is optimism. So, Rob, can I turn to strategy? And again, I'll embarrass you by reading back to you something you told me, I think, 5 years ago. It does not matter what strategies you adopt to achieve your goals, as long as they include optimism in the how and why. And you also said the secret ingredient, the secret sauce, if you like, of corporate and political strategies is optimism. It is a vital additive to achieving all the objectives of a goal or mission. Unfortunately, many leaders continue to include the word and its framework when developing their strategies. So how should the optimism principle influence strategic decision-making?
Well, it gets back to our overall thinking. Once again, in your strategic plans, your communication plans, your risk plans, your crisis plans. So you need to actually understand what is the environment in which we're working today. So once you understand that environment, what is the product you may be putting into that environment today? Once you understand those types of basic essentials, then you start to look at, okay, how do we actually push ourselves in innovation, inspiring people, and giving them confidence in the direction in which we're going. So it's really those three foundation areas, from my point of view, that you have to give the people that are, you know, if you're in a leadership situation, that type of inspirational confidence that they need to have. But don't forget, you know, if you look at your research components as well, you have to have an optimistic outcome or outlook in everything about research. Yes, you're going to have failures, but that's not to say you don't continue to pursue something and try to overcome, you know, those issues, etc. So from my point of view, optimism is a foundation that people need to actually study a lot more, not only for themselves, because to me, it's not just a self matter. To me, it's an organisational matter and it's a community matter.
Yeah, no, spot on. Now, look, last year, 2023, you know, the year coming out of COVID, we got approached by the Finnish organisation, the Art and Science of Joy. And for me, it was a big learning year. And because, you know, when I looked back at my book, I actually found 25 references to joy, but I hadn't focused on it as much as I did from being a partner of that Finnish organization. And, you know, joy is now very much a part of my everyday. And yeah, as we were going through that year, when I asked you about the connection, you quoted Shelley, you know, the English poet, and you said, "The soul's joy lies in doing," and that an optimistic outlook provides the trait that leads to joy. And I phrased it now, I say that the optimist feels more joy, and the joyful feel more optimistic. So how do you see that connection between optimism and joy in your life and work, and what would you commend to other people?
Well, I think optimism promotes happiness. So if you're optimistic, you do have a happy outlook on life. And I know having coffee with you from time to time where you engage the person serving the coffee and you ask, what is the best thing that happened to you today? And what that person has never thought about someone's asking that question of them. And immediately they're struck with having to think about what did happen to me today. And they respond accordingly. And they respond in a positive way. They don't respond in a negative way. So that to me promotes this joy of happiness and the foundation to a happier life. So joy, happiness, optimism is the foundation to it all. It's an engagement process, but don't forget, it also, and we referred to earlier, it also guards against depression. So people can actually train their mind to rethink situations and to overcome depression. Now, I know there's psychological aspects all associated with that, but science has proven that it can overcome or help overcome depression. So people should not always address things in a negative way. They got to look at what positive directions can I take to overcome certain situations.
Yeah,
and you look at in accidents today, you know, those people that respond to people that are caught in a damaged car or everything, people pull up at the side of the road and rush across to see if they can help them. Now, that to me is a basis of community goodwill, but it's a basis for people adopting an optimistic outlook on things. They respond accordingly to the health and welfare of people in an optimistic way.
Yeah, well, you remember we had that conversation with Kate Gould from Monash
Yes.
University, who runs a program called Relentless Optimism for People with Acquired Brain Injury. And, that notion of helping them to be the best they can be, even though they are limited, by the acquired brain injury. And she's quite a model in that. I think she's been, though her program is spreading across the country now.
Very true. And you just look, I'll look at the Paralympics at the moment that are on. Those people are inspirational in what they've overcome, but they're actually achieving global recognition for who they are and what they can achieve. It is inspirational from that point of view, but they've adopted an optimistic outlook on their life.
In some senses, like Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning and
Yeah.
Tragic Optimism, and also, the old, particularly girls' literature, Pollyanna, where all sorts of awful things happened to her, but the glad game was what she played, which was in whatever circumstances she was in, what is a light you can see at the end of the tunnel? So it wasn't, how it's sometimes portrayed, these days, you're a Pollyanna. But it's not that seeing a silver lining in every dark cloud. It's knowing that the dark cloud will pass.
That's right. And it's actually trying to participate in parting that dark cloud as well. You have to be part of it.
Now, resilience. The companies, government spending billions and billions on resilience, and every company at the drop of a hat is doing resilience training for their staff. But optimism is the key trait. You can't be resilient unless you believe that persisting is going to lead to a better result. So, you've been involved in this now for, 10 years, this research we've done. How do you believe an optimistic mindset contributes to resilience in the face of adversity?
Well, there's a major element in organisations and government today called community engagement. So, community engagement to me is the basis of government and businesses, etc., want to actually support each other or support their stakeholders. It's as simple as that. So, it's understanding what that support process is in building resilience into the community. How do I get the community to be part and parcel of what I have to do? And as you know, here in Australia, we have the bushfires, we have the floods, so when we have our droughts, resilience then comes into the equation by saying, how do we make ourselves more resilient? Well, that's where people actually engage with each other, learn from each other, and build that resilience into those types of communities because it's backed by processes. So it becomes a very important part of that whole resilience movement in communities, but also in organisations as well. So it's in principally to me, it's engagement, understanding what people have gone through and what you want to do to help them have a better life post a particular situation. That's building resilience so they know what to do in the future.
Yeah, we've talked about that. I mean, for a leader to bring optimism to a company or an organization, it's not the big man or woman speaking from the podium. It's the person who can unlock the optimism in the team. And, I love to stir up workers by saying, you can be the tea lady of optimism, lead by walking around. It doesn't need to be the CEO. You can be, the most junior person in the office, but if you're the one doing the round spreading optimism, and I say to people, you go down to the cafe, you spend $5.80 on a coffee, you've paid for a seat and a table. What's the point of taking it back and hiding behind your desk? And so we need to foster, that, sense of being together and surrounding yourself with the optimists. And, you know, I just think, you know, there's so many little tips and tricks, you know, smiling and saying hello to people. And, you know, you talked about depression. You know, the gratitude journal, just at the end of the day, writing down the three best things in the day and reading it again in the morning. I think the University of Pennsylvania has shown for most people with mild depression, it's much more effective than medication.
Yeah. And one of the things that I'm always interested in, politicians do community walks, street walks, etc. You know, engage with the baby and the mother and all that, and engage with the shop owner across the counter and things like that. Now, that to me is an engagement process, but what they're trying to do is instill with my presence there that there is optimism in the nature of the action. When you, as you said earlier, when you get a CEO who walks the floor, who walks through the factory, who goes up and down, you know, 10 floors, walking to people, they should do it on a regular basis, because that's engagement. That's an understanding of exactly what the, or you're seeking an understanding of what those people are facing each day. And you become human to them, because why? You're inspiring confidence in that, in those people, in you, that you can actually hear what you've actually said to, he's heard what he's, or she has heard what has been said to him or her. And therefore, I believe this person will actually inspire me and inspire the organization. So walking the floor is an important part of any key management leadership situation today. You cannot sit in your ivory tower, so to speak, or behind your big desk and expect to make decisions and others will follow.
Yeah.
They don't appreciate that today.
No, you're absolutely spot on that. I'm quite cheeky, really. Sometimes I tell the people in my workshops to go back to the office and graffiti the mirror with "the leader looks like the person in your mirror." And I encourage young people, I say, oh, when you're in the lift with the boss, you won't get into trouble by saying, "and what's been the best thing in your day?" And I gave a speech at Macquarie Bank about, oh, it must be 8 weeks ago now. And one of the CEOs in the room left slightly misinterpreting my message, but he rang me a week later and said, "I've been asking my staff in every conversation, what brings you joy?" And of course, when the boss says, "what's brought you joy at work today?" people are going to think, and you know, he was convinced that it had made his office a much happier place.
Yeah. Well, as you know, from engagement with restaurant staff and everything like that, that person remembers you. So it's a different form of engagement, but it's an effective form of engagement, because you've taken your time to ask them about themselves, as opposed to you telling them something.
Yeah, I do. I'm so cheeky now in my old age, Rob, that when someone says, "how are you?" You know, people don't expect a proper answer. But I say, "thank you for asking. You know, I'm feeling really good. And tell me what's been the best thing in your day." And the other day I was in New York, and I had to walk 5 blocks from the place that I was staying to the UN headquarters. And I made up my mind to smile and say hello to everyone. And of course, in New York, you know, a lot of people try to avoid eye contact and they've got ear pods in and the like. But I had 12 good conversations in those 5 blocks. You know, it was with workmen who were building a working site. There were some garbos. You know, there was a policeman standing on a corner. So I showed up that even in the toughest market,
yeah,
you know, New York, that smiling and saying hello to everyone still works. And I still remember, you know, I'm not Hindu by religion, but I was strongly influenced by the Brahma Kumaris, which is a women-led Hindu sect. And their leader, Daddy Janki, died a couple of years ago at the age of 103. And after she died, they were still sending out, you know, her sermons, you know, bits of it. And one popped up in my box. And it was actually the day before I was doing the Macquarie Bank speech. And it said, "most people have trouble smiling. So when you smile, smile at them with a genuine smile. And so I've now added that to my patter. I think she was speaking to me from the dead. So I say to people, smile and say hello to everyone and make sure it's a genuine smile. And you know how to do that, Rob. You lift people in every conversation.
Very true. Very true. You do get that. But I think it's within the questions that you ask, because the questions you're asked are ones that the person has to think about themselves and what is happening to themselves, and in a positive way. Because when you ask what's the best thing that happened to you today, or what you're planning to do to make today a better day, they are positive questions, and that's where the optimism comes out.
Yeah, well, and that's been our basic research. We've now asked 40,000 people, what makes you optimistic? And except for the one word answers, almost everyone is different.
Yes.
So listeners, it's Victor Perton here, I'm talking to Robert Masters about the optimism principle, which asserts that the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. So innovation, Rob, I would say that a pessimist can't innovate, that only an optimist can innovate, because innovation requires having a crack, accepting failure, having another crack, accepting failure. And my favorite example is Dyson, you know, the vacuum cleaner guy, who famously says that he had 5,000 iterations of the bagless vacuum cleaner, 15 years of trial and error before he achieved success. So from your perspective, having worked in so many corporations and having worked in the media and the like, can you share with your wisdom of what role does optimism play in innovation, and how can an optimistic outlook fuel creativity and progress?
Well, it gets back to what Churchill said, doesn't it? You know, that the optimist sees every opportunity, and so in any difficulty. And I think that's the foundation that people should start to adopt, that no matter what you're doing, look at how we can actually address this in a positive way or achieve an outcome. And it could be, you know, the simplest tasks around the yard or in the house, but also in the work approach that you take. Treat it as an opportunity to actually achieve an outcome, as opposed to a burden of having to do something or a negative from that. Society today is far too pessimistic in many of the issues that they're confronting, rather than saying, well, what are the real opportunities here for us? So to me, leaders have to do this. They have to inspire, they have to create, they have to be innovative, but they also have to be engaging in what they do. And I'd like to see a lot more trust built into their communication process. There is a thing called the OECD that does a scan, and they're doing global scans on countries at the moment. And one is trust in government. And and this was the latest one that was released on the UK. And the trust in government in the UK is declining significantly. And it's principally because they haven't engaged society in the way that they should be, and to bring them along in the direction in which which the leaders are aspiring to do. So, you know, I would basically encourage more and more people to look at optimism as a foundation in how they're actually going about their day-to-day work, but also in their leadership and also in their strategies.
I think I saw a study from YouGov that was published this week, and they've been tracking optimism in the UK for several years. They reckon only 1 in 5 English people will say they're optimistic. And it's an open question. It's not a negative question. It's actually put, you know, what emotion are you feeling?
Yeah.
And optimism's at rock bottom in the UK. It's... Yeah. You know, no wonder they're having economic problems.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think next time I interview you, I'd like to talk to you about the problem of the English language, because that GHD study in which I interviewed them the other day, the 5 countries with rock bottom views on their confidence in leadership and confidence in the future were Australia, Canada, the UK, the US, and New Zealand. You know, the Filipinos, the Singaporeans, the Chileans, the North Africans were all startlingly optimistic compared to us. So I'd love to, I won't put you on the handle now, but I think something's happening in the English language or either English media or English education curricula. You know, the books that are dystopian rather than utopian. You know, the science fiction that leads you to think we're in a cataclysm, you know, rather than in a race to the future. But have you got some views to share now?
Well, I would like, it touches on a subject that is also close to my heart, and that's on democracy and the foundations for democracy. And, you know, in Australia, for instance, you know, we have our values, and to me, democracy is based on values. And the keys to the Australia in values are freedom, respect, fairness, and equality of opportunity. And they say that our values define and shape our country. Now, I thought those words, those four key values and that positioning line actually should be at the heart of everything we should start to do. And that's a democratic society, and how do we actually live those values? Because I've just was involved with a company, and it had redefined some of its values and everything like that, and they just used the one words, you know, things like respectful, consultative, etc. And then I asked the question, what is the meaning of each of those words to this organisation? And they hadn't given any further thought to that. Now, that to me is a lost opportunity from that point of view. So when we talk about, you know, democracies and organisations that are based on values, how are they actually being implemented in society? So I'd welcome the opportunity to speak to you about that, because I think it's a major matter for everyone now, because in every annual report, you see the values are put up there, but often you don't see, you see a little definition, but then you don't see exactly how they're implementing those values.
It's funny, my son went to the same school that your son went to, I think, and like all teenage boys, you know, there was a bit of a kerfuffle, and one of the newspapers or television channels, you know, covered it, you know, and the headmaster sent out this letter, you know, it's, you know, we're sorry about this. And I rang him up and I said, sorry, your school is one that lives its values. They're not just written on the blackboard or on a poster. You know, your kids, you know, doing the Walk for Women, you know, they're doing incredible stuff for charity. You know, they're doing all sorts of things. And I just thought that's a rush to apologize for just being. Whereas, you know, that particular school, I just saw it through the kids, you know, that they were living their values, you know, rather than using posters. And, you know, teenagers will act up, or three teenagers will act up. And we take an adverse view of where young people are. Now, before you run out of voice, because I've stretched your generosity, the optimism principle suggests that optimism can be a guiding star even in the darkest times. How do you personally stay optimistic during the difficult times that you've had?
Well, I think it gets back to what we said right at the start. It is an underlying element of any person's or my makeup. I believe in having a positive outlook on things and approaching anything in a positive in a positive way for an outcome. I don't want to give up on anything from that point of view. Having said that, I do recognise that on some things you cannot achieve. So that's being realistic, and that's the realistic optimism approach to things. So I think I would like to see more and more people engage the way you engage with outside people that you don't know. To me, that's an engagement process, an understanding process, but it's also an inspirational process. So from my point of view, I like to engage people in a positive way, an optimistic way, and ask the right questions about how does it make them feel? Because once they give a positive response, you actually are imbued with that positivity as well. So it makes your day as well. So that's how I like it. And hopefully, with my golf, I could get more pars than I do bogeys. So that's optimism as well.
Hey, brilliant, brilliant. So finally, Rob, what advice would you give to someone looking to cultivate more optimism in their life and work?
I think the two things, engagement is the most, to me, is the most important thing. Look at the values, your own personal values, or you can take the nation's values and work with those and actually see how you will actually bring those into effect in your own life. And that's an engagement in, you know, all walks of life from that, because the values are there for everyone. They've been thought through. I don't think they're being implemented the way I'd like them to be implemented or understood. So to me, that's the important things, that people have the opportunity here. As you know, from coming back to Australia a number of years ago now, but having lived in America, there is opportunity in everything. Australia is regarded as, despite some of the research, you know, a lucky country. We should embrace being a lucky country. Yes, we have adversity. Everyone has adversities, but we are a lucky country. We do have a great open space to actually share with many, many people. But having said that, the values are the underlying element of how this society should exist.
Well, I think that's a great way to conclude. Thank you, Robert Masters. We've been talking with Robert Masters about the optimism principle, which asserts that the answer to life's most pressing questions is optimism. It's gone up on the website today. Feel free to read the research behind it. And Rob Masters, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for your leadership and your wisdom and sharing the optimism principle today.
Thank you very much, Victor, and for the opportunity to be with you. So it's always enjoyable. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed this podcast, you might like to get involved in our study and our work and our joy at the Centre for Optimism. Pretty easy to get involved, centreforoptimism.com. And you can also find Victor Perton and Robert Masters on LinkedIn, on Twitter, Substack, YouTube, podcasts on Apple. So get involved. And the fundamental question is, what makes you optimistic? And as you're greeting people today, just try this trick. In the greeting, don't ask how are you. Replace it with what's been the best thing in your day, and you'll find every conversation in the day will get better and better. Best wishes for a great day, and that's the end of this podcast.